Welcome to the People's Game. This is Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by
Fernando,
Jennifer,
and Pablo.
On today's show, we are going to be speaking with Matthew Cobb, Manchester City fan, evolutionary biologist, and he can talk about the de-evolution of the English national side. And then we'll be joined by Nick Green, who's furious about the refereeing in the USA match that seemed to rob the American team of what was rightly theirs, 3 points against Slovenia. But nonetheless, the comeback was spectacular to earn a draw. And after that, we'll go from Algeria to Serbia to Greece. We'll speak to Hamoud Salih, a journalist and a fan of Algeria, Sirjan Ilic, a blogger, big fan of Serbia, and finally, Tomos Mikolakos, who celebrated Greece's first ever World Cup victory yesterday. And then we go back to England to wrap the show up with Paul Mason, the economics editor of BBC Newsnight. But up first, our roundtable. And boy, it was again every day more dramatic than the previous one, and this was something else, including the drama of an utterly flat performance by England. So Pablo, the man behind the film, Gringos at the Gate, the Gringos were at the gate. They again passed through the gate for a second, and the referee said, no, back here on the other side.
Yeah, that was, wow, what an emotional roller coaster this morning was. Well, you know, they didn't play very well in the first half. We always worry about the U.S. giving up early goals, and they fulfilled that promise and playing to the level of their opponents, and that happened. And then they rallied. They, as usual, you know, their backs against the wall. They came up and played an amazing second half, I felt, and fully deserved the win. And we'll have to figure out exactly. We'll have to call Clinton and find out from the State Department what we did to Mali to deserve that.
Yeah, I know. Actually, Pablo and I watched the game together this morning, and it was I don't know when I've been so anxious and so nervous. I mean, that first half was just so discouraging. And it's often said of the game that it's a game of two halves. And, you know, it was a completely different story after halftime. I had joked, actually, that that they were watching highlights of the women's national team previous successful World Cup campaigns for inspiration. Dare to Dream, the HBO documentary, anything to look for inspiration, because they did not look inspired. And then it was just a different team in the second half. It was a fabulous performance.
You know, one of the things, and this has been a theme in recent installments of the People's Game, is the question of nationalism. And I think a lot of the people we've spoken to, and all of us, the hosts of the show, the co-hosts, were mainly internationalists. And I think the paradox of the American men's team, I'm not really that gung-ho pro-America when it comes to sports sides, but the paradox of this team is it's actually, in the context of our culture in the United States and the dominant hegemonic culture, to be a soccer fan and to root for the men's team is to be sort of a surreptitious internationalist, because their success brings the global game more into America and unifies us with the rest of the world. That's only going to happen if the, you know, ESPN, ABC, put some money behind it, start supporting soccer broadcasts, start supporting the American national team, and when they fail, you know, the backing of the tournament sort of declined. I mean, I'm so psyched to have them do better.
I don't know. I mean, I'm gonna resist that just a little bit, because it sounds awfully missionary-like to me.
It is missionary.
Yeah, but I think it's too that, you know, these guys, compared to, say, for example, the guys who, you know, won the WNBA. Sorry, that's an interesting slip on my part. The NBA finals last night. I mean, they make next to nothing. You know, so and compared to for the guys who played like crap for England today, they also, you know, don't make very much money. So I think there's a kind of, I hate to say, because it's totally romantic to say this, but, you know, a romanticism to rooting for this team, because they're really in it for the love of the game. I mean, there is no reason to choose this sport as an American athlete of extraordinary ability unless you really, honest to God, love the game. You're going against the flow.
I was myself. I was pleasantly surprised. I was after the United States Slovenia game ended. I checked my Facebook. I checked a lot of things online. I was pleasantly surprised. A lot of my friends who are either immigrants themselves or children of immigrants, you know, just so like angry about the fact that the U.S. were robbed. You know, just cheering for this team. So I was really just pleasantly surprised at the fact that you know, children of Mexican parents or El Salvadoran parents or Guatemalan parents or anywhere in the world were like, why? What happened? Why were we robbed? That kind of, so I was just really glad. I mean, pleasant surprise that that was a sentiment amongst even the immigrant community who was cheering for the American team.
It's that word "we," right? It gets awfully kind of mobile and expansive with both Mexico and the U.S. In the southwestern part of the U.S.
But it also speaks to the uniqueness of the United States soccer culture, that we are underdogs within this larger dominant culture. And so I'm almost an anti-nationalist when it comes to almost anything else that goes on in the world politically.
Likewise.
But ever since I was a kid traveling through Argentina, where my family's primarily, and was as a child, basically, you can't play because you're from the United States, you don't understand the game, you don't this, you don't, you know, that just, it may builds inside you a desire to see the stars and stripes, you know, at least rise to the level that, you know, you feel that it should, because we're a great, wonderful country, I swear to God. Even when we have people like George Bush in the Oval Office, we are a great country.
You know, that was that little, like, chip on his shoulder sort of, so there, thing to Landon Donovan's goal, I thought. It was a real, I mean, it was definitely, I'm going to do it myself if nobody else on the team is going to be there for me to pass the ball to. But, I mean, it was emphatic the opening shot, the opening goal, rather, for the U.S. squad. And it seemed to be made to prove a point, so...
The rugged individualist takes it on his own shoulders to just stick it to this, you know, to the world. You know, so that's what it is. When the U.S. plays, a good percentage of the world just wants us to lose just because we're so good at everything else.
Well, it's funny because I suppose my point, and again, I appreciate the Jennifer's take on what my point is, but I suppose what I'm saying is I root for them as an anti-nationalist.
Yeah.
And they're not my total top side, as I confess over and over again guiltily. I root for Italy when it comes to this tournament. And in global soccer among the national teams. I recognize that the Italian side has a really ugly nationalism about it, okay? But the USA team, I actually root for them, and I think it can be just part, a very small part, of eviscerating what has been USA gung-ho nationalism in my lifetime, which is to bring us into the global game and to have us be part of this fantastic global culture that has largely been excluded from the mainstream in the United States.
Can I just observe, though, I was so irritated by the endless kind of Facebook, Twitter-type comments about the size of Slovenia versus the size of the United States, the smallest country versus the largest country, and I mean, it just, and playing in the World Cup tournament and sort of in terms of population, Slovenia, you know, as one of my favorite bloggers put it, you know, ripped the spine out of Russia to kick them out of the World Cup finals. They are a strong and athletic and smart team. I mean, they are one of the teams to beat, really, and they're an intimidating team. I mean, who cares how many people live in Slovenia, which is a lovely country, by the way, with a fantastic performance art scene.
Right, but actually, you say that, and there's an added paradox to it, which is that they actually are larger than the American players. You know, the except for Gooch, who might have been the largest guy out there.
And I was actually reading a book by Simon Cooper, who also wrote Soccer Against the Enemy. His latest book is called Soccernomics, and he devotes a large chunk of his book to that, how these countries like the United States, like Turkey, like Russia, like Japan, these countries with really big populations and really like high GDP will overtake the global game because of factors like that. But that's why you play the game, you know.
Now, if you go by that logic, Jamaica shouldn't be cleaning up in the sprints, right? For example, you know, Jamaica produces an outrageous percentage of the top sprinters in the world. It's a very small country, right? That has there's the size of the country and the population, I think, has far less to do with these things than the football associations, the culture of the development of the sport, the love for the sport, the organization, right, of the national squad. I mean, Slovenia is just they were a great looking team, and and it was a great game. I mean, they fought as well. I mean, it was a hard fought and probably, I'd say, the best game so far.
Right. And on the point in terms of population, and of course, it does have a very high per capita wealth, but the Netherlands is, it's now established as one of the top soccer playing nations in the world, and it is more than one third smaller than any of the other top soccer playing nations in the world, the next smallest being Argentina in terms of population. But the Netherlands has a population of about 12 million people, and it's fully established. So, you know, Slovenia is a lot closer to 12 million than 310 million, but Netherlands proves that's certainly not a determining factor.
You know, I've read Simon Cooper's book, and I think that the big fallacy behind it is this idea that all things being equal in terms of the passion for the game. You know, as I've been doing this documentary on the differences between the U.S. and the Mexican soccer culture, one thing that really struck me is that how, as much as, let's say, someone like myself who's very much looking forward to someday the United States getting a passionate soccer culture, the Mexicans look to Argentina and Brazil and go, oh, I wish we were as passionate as them,
yeah.
You know. And so I think that disparity and just this sort of historical context of the sort of the passion for the game, the love for the game, is so much more important, as Jennifer just said, than the economic power of a country or even population size.
And, of course, if you go back in football history and not too far back, you know, certainly Hungary was one of had a generation in which they were, you know, probably for about a 7 to 10 year period, one of the top three soccer playing nations in the world. They've completely fallen off the map. You had the Stoichkov Bulgaria generation, the Hagi Romania generation, again, national sides that have really fallen off. So, you know, it ebbs and flows. Though the Dutch, certainly since the invention of a total football, have hung out now for, they're into their fourth decade. So there's something to that. It can get established, and that has to do with, I suppose, the institutional structure of the sport within the country.
Oh, it's a great game, that's for sure. There's no two ways about it. I mean,
it was good for the game in the United States that they came back. I think that if they had just folded like England and not put up much of a struggle, I think it would have set the whole soccer program back another 5 to 10 years, which they really can't afford, you know.
Well, I do think if we look at the team, though, right now, we're only two games in. Huge game coming up against Algeria. That could be a very tricky matchup for the USA. At the same time, maybe they'll pull off a victory against Algeria. It's really hard to tell. That team certainly showed itself to be a very talented side today against England.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this World Cup reminds me a lot of 2002, outside of the fact that France folding. It's a game where in the first round you just don't know what's going to happen.
Right, and for what it's worth, though, 2002 ended up a little flat down the stretch. I mean, I really felt Brazil was really only the top side that made it through, and so we'll see how this plays out. But it's extremely dramatic right now, and I think it really has captured the world's attention. Jennifer, what have you been blogging about?
What have I been blogging about? Well, I did actually write a piece about France needing to do its penance for that handball. And I have a piece about music and listening to the World Cup, which I'm working on this weekend. And also this weekend, a piece should be coming out, and it's not on the blog, but it's in The Guardian in their comments section, about asking the question of why, when in the last World Cup, the FIFA organized a visible campaign against racism in response to the racism directed at black players, especially in Europe, that this World Cup, which is staged in the country with the highest incidence of rape in the world, and in a country who lost a retired national team player in their women's team to gang rape and murder, there's been no effort to organize a campaign raising awareness about violence against women. So it's a pretty serious topic, and that should be appearing in The Guardian this weekend.
And awesome. for what it's worth, actually, when you say it's in the comment section, that sounds like it's at the tail end of somebody's blog. That's the way The Guardian calls their op-ed pages.
Yeah. Right? And I should say this is something that's been inspired by the work that John Turnbull's been doing on The Global Game, his blog, and conversations that we've been having. And he wrote a beautiful recent piece, actually, about lesbian footballers in South Africa. And that was a piece that was inspired by Yudi Simelane, which is the name of the South African national team player who was murdered. And he just writes in such a touching and emotional way about her story that it put it back in my mind. And I thought that I should just ask that question, why FIFA doesn't see women, in essence, as a part of its community when it comes to the World Cup.
And a great conversation that we had with John Turnbull was on the People's Game radio show just a few days ago. The thing that I've been trying to develop and I'll be working on in the coming days is this question of whether football is a friend of the left or an enemy of the left, and conversely a friend to capitalism or an enemy to capitalism. Again, Terry Eagleton, the British intellectual, has chimed in saying that soccer is indeed the opiate of the masses, and of course I feel quite counter.
I just get so tired of these. Sometimes you see leftist literary critics who, on the one hand, make gestures towards having a fondness for the people, but actually can't stomach popular culture.
Right.
I just think I've gone on the record about this before, and I think that comment, that piece, which I believe was that in the
yes, it was in The Guardian.
It was in The Guardian, and
June 15th.
Shame on them for publishing that.
Indeed. Well, Eagleton will get whatever he wants published. And, of course, the flip side of that is the ugly nativist idiocy of Glenn Beck on the right wing, which Dave Zirin has covered. And we'll be having Dave Zirin on in the coming days. But up next, we're going to go from country to country to country and cover the details of the unfolding World Cup 2010 on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and we are joined right now by Matthew Cobb in Manchester, England. Matthew Cobb is an evolutionary biologist, a scientific historian, and most importantly, a Manchester City supporter. But Matthew Cobb, the subject today is not Man City, who had a rather strong season this past year, but the English national side, which had a very weak day today. Matthew Cobb, what is wrong with England?
What is wrong with the English football team? Well, I think it's actually they are trapped by the success, the financial success of the Premiership. So the UK Premier, the English Premiership, has got all this money that's come flooding into it from Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV, the deal to have a bit pay-per-view for the matches, which has meant there's a vast amount of money come in. And the players are kind of stuck here, like, you know, they're like wasps attracted to honey. As a result, the English team just has the English tradition and English football to draw on. So even if you've got some incredibly talented players and a very talented manager, they're still players who basically do the kick and rush. You know, they hoof it up to the... Peter Crouch is a great player, but that's what they do. They kick, if Crouch is playing, they just kick it up to him. He's really tall and he's going to get it and put it in the net. And I think that when they come to up against teams that are made up of players who are playing in different areas then of the world and got different kind of traditions of playing and a mixture, that makes for a kind of thin and rather uninspired football team.
You saw over and over again today, Rooney would get the ball, turn, and think he could run at the defense, and there was an Algerian to take it off his foot. The marking, much tighter the marking, and very, very adept, minute play with the ball on the ground by the Algerians. It seemed very unfamiliar to the English.
Yeah, well, Rooney is a bit odd. He hasn't been playing very well for England for some months now, and I don't think, I mean, the English basically are relying on him. I suppose the other thing you've got to say, not in defense of the players, but you've got to remember that the British tabloid press is completely obsessed with the success of the English football team and with the minutiae of their stories. And Capello's got very annoyed with them, has found them very intrusive because they've been taking photographs and, you know, they can't even go out for a kind of very relaxation session without having the paparazzi taking pictures. And in their defense, I suppose you might say that creates both, you know, an irritating presence, but also a feeling of pressure from back home. But then all the teams get that. So, I mean, they certainly get the pressure from back home. But that's also part of this kind of commodification that's happened to football, especially in the last 20 years, as it's been really turned into this incredibly obsession. Somebody was pointing out the other day, I'm sure your listeners know, in 1966, England won the World Cup when it was in England. And somebody was saying that apparently on the Monday, the tabloid press didn't even have it on the front page or the back page. So it was a minor event. It'd kind of been forgotten in a day and a half. I mean, if England even gets to the final this time, you won't be able to hear, and it'll go on about it for a whole week.
Since I have you joining us, Matthew Cobb, a fan of Man City, and one of the objects of this show is to not only look at the games on the field, but also the economic, political, social, cultural subtext of the World Cup. Let's actually move away from the World Cup and talk about global football. Your club side, Man City, is an object lesson of how sides function in this age of global financial capital, because I believe it was only the beginning of last season they were pretty much bankrupt. And then all of a sudden they get bought by, I believe, money that came from the Gulf region, and they now have more money than pretty much any side in the world, and it's not a product of the fact that they've won games and they've built up a war chest. It just comes from outside. They're buying up talent, and now they're assumed to be one of the dominant sides in England in the coming years.
Absolutely. I mean, it's rather depressing, because on the one hand, you think, hey, we might actually win something, but then at what price? And I think an awful lot of fans feel this. I mean, the key example of this, in fact, is the other team, Manchester United. So they were bought up by the Glazers, who are US brothers who have a family that own sports clubs. And so this is entirely a money-making deal, and it ended up, they bought out all the shares, because supporters used to have shares, and it meant that the club ended up with massive, massive debt, and the supporters felt completely alienated. So they did two things. One, they went off and created their own football club, playing, you know, full of amateurs, And about 5,000-6,000 people support this amateur club, which is actually doing quite well. They call it FC United. And the other thing is that the supporters are actually having a campaign against the Glazers as this representative of this commodification of the game that's taken place in a global context. Manchester United's colours are red and white, and they wave the green and yellow flags and scarves of the ancestor of Manchester United, Newton Heath Football Club, which was set up at the end of the 19th century. So I think a lot of fans are really quite fed up about this because they recognise that we're going to end up with a situation in which it'll be three or four clubs, and the money doesn't have any relationship. Money they dispose doesn't have any relationship to their fan base. Manchester City's got a very good, vibrant, working-class fan base, especially in Manchester. But the money that we put in is nothing compared to the money that the new owners have put in. And as a result, everybody is now being associated. All players are now being associated with Manchester City because an agent knows that they can get an awful lot of money if they can convince City to buy them. So the game has got turned into this kind of circus with agents making money out of it. And even some players like Tevez, who's been playing for City and is a fantastic player. He used to play for Manchester United. He came across the City. He went from the red side to the blue side. And he's not actually owned by anybody. He's actually owned by a consortium. He's not his own man. He really is a wage slave. It's absolutely bizarre.
Thank you for that. That is tremendous insight into the economy of contemporary global football from a Manchester City perspective. And lastly, though, Matthew Cobb, will the English side pull itself up off the mat and be competitive in this World Cup?
No, I don't think so. I mean, are they going to pull themselves up? I'm not sure, but there's no way they're going to win. I don't think any except the most crazed English supporters think they're going to win. I like the look of Argentina myself. I was very impressed by them last night.
Oh, that must make you popular in England.
Well, I think a lot of people, they like good football, and they see the rubbish that they saw tonight, and they're not going to be happy. They'd rather see a team with Messi and Tevez and the others. I mean, they had real spirit. They wanted to win.
Right. Maradona seems to be able to instill that in him as he was with himself.
He has the hand of God.
Yes, as opposed to the hand of Claude. Thank you so much, Matthew Cobb, evolutionary biologist, scientific historian, and, of course, Man City supporter. Thank you for joining us here on The People's Game.
You're very welcome. See you then. It's
Alan Minsky, and I'm joined once again by Nick Green. His blog is 100% Soccer, and I find him to be the most trenchant analyst of the U.S. Men's World Cup side 2010.
Today, I've got to say, was one of the most disappointing experiences I've had as an American journalist following the U.S. team. It was an absolutely terrible performance, especially in the first half. There was some very questionable tactical and coaching decisions, I thought. And to top it off, after a remarkable comeback engineered by the Galaxy's Landon Donovan, to be denied in such a fashion by that alleged referee was extremely difficult to take. It was a remarkable day, actually, Alan, of soccer, starting with Germany
right.
and Serbia, that fantastic upset, and then continuing on all day long. I am tired, if you cannot tell. I'm emotionally spent. It was pretty amazing.
Well, again, let me just reiterate to listeners out there, when the U.S. Men's World Cup team is not under the spotlight, Nick, who works for the Daily Breeze, which is based in Torrance, California, right near Carson, where the U.S. men's team trains. Nick Green is following the team, putting it under the microscope and all of its evolution step by step. Now, you know this team inside and out. What were the mistakes that you felt Coach Bradley did in approaching this game against Slovenia?
The American defense was just so immobile that I'm not sure that anything Bob Bradley could have done could have solved that. And that was a major part of the issue. Now, Bradley had, I didn't agree with starting Robbie Finlay up front, and I think his inexperience showed greatly today on at least a couple of occasions. He could have made more of plays if he had had the vision that he just didn't possess. At halftime, you would have thought that Bradley would have made some significant changes. I didn't think his son was particularly effective, although he did come through with a goal in the 80th minute. But I'm certainly questioning his halftime decisions. You can tell I'm frankly kind of bewildered with what I saw to a great extent. If it wasn't for the very inspired play of Landon Donovan, I'm wondering where the U.S. would have been at the end of the day.
Well, I actually thought that while the second goal was so dramatic, the second United States goal was so dramatic by Bradley, but the first goal was just an utter thing of beauty, and the performance of a player on the world stage at the absolute height of his powers, tremendous confidence, control of the whole landscape in front of him as he moved down the touchline towards the goal, and then what a shot. I mean, that was the thing of absolute beauty. And, of course, if that goal had not occurred then, I don't think the U.S. Makes it back in that match.
I agree with you completely. It was a very direct goal. It was Chirundolo up the wing, straight to Landon Donovan, and then Donovan did his thing. And, you know, it was funny. I saw the look on Donovan's face, and it was almost as if he said, okay, I'm going to take this over. You guys can't do it. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to single-handedly get us back into this. And he did that. And I've seen that so many times with the Galaxy where he can just take over a game, and at that moment, it was just, this is the best American player ever. And he got the U.S. single-handedly back into that game. And the way he took it, as you pointed out, it was just so supremely confident, just blasted it home. It was a thing of beauty.
And then the service in the goal that was denied was, I mean, it couldn't be more picture perfect. And well, you know, they've just scored. It's the 86th minute. How many players in the world right now can put that ball in the absolute perfect spot? And it was driven home beautifully by Adu, whose confidence I felt grew as by the 75th, 80th minute. I thought he was really doing a great job.
Yeah, he did put a foot wrong or two occasionally, but that goal just leaves me bewildered as well. Why it wasn't a goal is completely beyond me. I've spent the entire afternoon looking at ESPN and watching that replay over and over again. I cannot think what Maurice Adu did wrong. You can see around him the two Slovenian players holding two U.S. players, obviously a foul in the other direction. It's rare at this level of competition to see an utterly bizarre refereeing decision. And yes, you are right. Maurice Adu did so well to put that away that it's so disappointing that it doesn't matter.
Well, you know, it's a circumstance now where the United States is going to have to win. They could get through by drawing. For what it's worth, let's look at the group right now. England versus Slovenia. I think England had a terrible time, but part of the problem was that they didn't match up well with Algeria. I actually think that the English side matches up very well against Slovenia. I don't think that Slovenia's game is different enough from what these players do experience every week in the Premiership. And since they are superior and more dominant players than the players on the Slovenian side, I will really be surprised if England doesn't come away with 3 points against Slovenia, which will mean that the United States will have to win the match against Algeria. And as we saw today, that side is not as weak as people have been assuming that it is. So what do you make of the final set of games in the first round in Group C?
Well, I admire your analysis, and I think you're being very, very generous to England. Perhaps I'm just being a pessimistic Englishman, but that was an absolutely abysmal performance.
Oh, I completely agree. It was atrocious. It was flatter than flat.
If we thought the U.S. was bad in the first half, England outdid the U.S. in its suckitude. I mean, I apologize for the less than technical term, but, I mean, that was just appalling. It was funny because at halftime, they showed the highlights, and they showed one shot on goal by England, and that was it. And it didn't get any better in the second half, and if anything, it deteriorated. Algeria was brighter, faster, better, more inventive. I enjoyed watching them. It was utter, it was so cruel to watch England. That was just a terrible performance. I have to go. I'm going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go watch Japan versus the Netherlands at a Donpachi restaurant at the Miyako Hybrid Hotel. I'm determined to drink in the full range of ethnic experiences Southern California has to offer during this World Cup. And that's been the most one of the most fun things to me.
Oh, no, it's absolutely incredible. Southern California, again, for those listeners out there who don't know, I argue that only New York City challenges it as the most ethnically diverse metropolitan area in the world. So all 32 sides have support in Southern California from people who are hyphen Americans, whether they're Danish Americans, Cameroon Americans, Australian Americans, Japanese American, Dutch Americans. They're all here in Southern California. Nick Green, 100% Soccer is the blog. Thank you so much and enjoy your dreams.
Thank you. Always fun talking to you.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
Fernando Romero.
And we are joined by Hamoud Salih, who is an Algerian, who is also host of Radio Intifada on KPFK Radio Los Angeles. And Hamoud is joining us to talk both about the performance today of the Algerian national team against England and also about the national football culture of Algeria. Hamoud, first off, today's action, what did you think? I was extremely impressed by Algeria, a lot more flair than a very flat British side.
Yes, it was actually a great game, and the Algerians are celebrating. They saw this tie as a win, and they are expecting to do better, even better, against the United States next Wednesday.
That's going to be a tough game.
Now, apparently the team watched the movie Battles of Algiers in advance of the game today. Had you heard about that?
No, I really didn't. But I could imagine, for one obvious reason, the Algerian team is composed of players who play soccer in European teams. There are in fact only two players who play in Algeria. So for them, this would be a good opportunity to get in touch with the Algerian history. I'm not saying they don't know the history, but this would be a good thing, I think, for them to understand it much better, the context of what is at play here.
In fact, I believe the majority of the team were actually raised in France in their youth.
Yes, yes, and that's really what some critics are saying, that the sport itself in Algeria is still at very, very underdeveloped. Stadiums are not very, very well built. There are huge, huge problem infrastructure. But this team brought a national spirit, and it makes it makes everybody happy. But it hides the fact that Algeria soccer in Algeria is very, very well behind any other team in the world. It could last probably ranked among the last 10 teams in the whole world in terms of infrastructure.
But in terms of the support of the people in Algeria, I mean, compare it to other soccer crazed countries, which are so many in the world. Is it comparable to any nation in the world?
I'll tell you, Alan, I've been visiting Algeria almost every year, at least twice a year. I have never seen the kind of support that this team has, the kind of nationalism that Algerians have shown for this team, for their national team. A reason for it is Algeria, remember, is under a huge terrorism attacks almost on a daily basis. The country has not been at peace for over a decade now, and this kind of brought some relief. It's a way for them to forget what's happening, and they enjoy it. When I was there back in January, flags were everywhere. The talk on television, radio, and the street is all about the soccer team, and it's the same thing today. It's brought a lot of joy, and it's an environment, an atmosphere that we have not seen in Algeria for quite some time. In fact, one could say we have never seen before like it.
Wow, yeah, that doesn't surprise me, given I think they brought something extra to. It sounds so hackneyed to say this, but it felt like they had something extra going for them on the field today, that they had a singularity of purpose.
Right.
I was also really impressed by the keeper, because he, if I remember right, this is his first international game ever. And he played with an incredible confidence, and it was a pleasure to watch them pick England apart, who really barely deserved to be on the field, frankly. They looked great, and the next game is going to be a really interesting one, I think, that these are two teams with a lot to prove and a lot riding on them individually.
They're too, Jennifer. And what they had going for them is there is this pride, because they fought a hard battle against Egypt for the qualifying match. During that match, the Egyptians, for whatever reason, accused Algerians or insulted what Algerians saw as insults to their pride. The press even used some derogatory statements. Some of them went even to say that all Algerians are terrorists. They did not deserve to have a revolution. So they were really attacked. Their pride was attacked. And the same things. So these things has been behind their back for many months.
Yeah.
And this was another to them. This is an opportunity to showcase their pride, and they did it in more ways than one. But the real match is Wednesday, and everybody's talking about it. They think they're going to surprise everybody, and they believe that they can do it.
The USA versus Algeria, obviously the United States and the political signification of the United States playing a country from the Muslim world, from the Middle East. How significant do you think that will be in the build-up to the match, and do you think that Algeria will see themselves as playing for the entire Muslim world and for the Middle East?
Oh, definitely. That is how it's played. Remember, soccer is really political in this part of the world.
Yeah.
It's not just the United States. It's the United States as a superpower, United States even as an imperial power. It's United States supporting of Israel. All these are into play, and this is how it's being projected in the media. In fact, the newspaper that is sponsoring the Algerian team in South Africa, it has tendencies or Islamist tendencies, and it has been writing a lot about this game, and it's sort of, to them, this is a win against the biggest power. So politics is at play here, and the Algerians do see themselves as a representative of this Muslim world, and they pride themselves on that. And in addition to that, they think that they could repeat what they did in 1982 when they defeated Germany, and that game is still a historical game, and they see this as another opportunity. In many ways, some of the commentators so far that I heard on the radio, they think that they haven't achieved what they were to achieve. Namely, they thought they could beat England, and if they beat the United States, that would be their biggest achievement of this tournament.
Yeah.
And, of course, in 1982, for those who don't know, they were basically cheated out of the opportunity to play in the second round by collusion between the Austrian and West German teams, a game which actually led to a change in the FIFA rules such that this final set of third-round matches are now played simultaneously so that teams cannot collude in the same way. Again, the victim of that match was Algeria. Lastly, I do want to ask, Zinedine Zidane has been counseling the team. This is a bit of a gratuitous question, but I do feel I need to ask it. Clearly, maybe the dominant figure, player in global soccer from the past, say, decade and a half. How significant has he been to the place of soccer in Algerian society, and how significant is he that he's helping the team in the way that he is these days?
His role has been sort of a consultant, and of course, I think he has played a role in preparing players and so on and so forth. But what it adds to it is that Zidane is really a hero in Algeria. He's seen more of an Algerian than French, and somehow the fact that he played for a French team and not an Algerian team has not been a variable to Algerians. They see him as Algerian. The other thing is that he's received as a national leader. When he visits Algeria, he's the guest of the president. Whenever he tours, whenever he goes, there are huge crowd of people receiving him. So he has been a big factor in a big supporter of Algerian soccer. In addition to, for some reason, and this is politics in the third world, his city, which is in the mountains, for many years did not even have paved road. Because of his visit to his mother and one of his relatives, now that city or that place where he lives, the village most likely, is now paved and it's taken care of. So even the community is benefiting out of his celebrity status. Mm-hmm. So Zidane has been a big contributor to soccer and has been very well received by all Algerians. And Algerians see him as an Algerian more than French, and they have never questioned his allegiance to France or anything of that sort.
And lastly, the celebrations in Algeria today, did the people take to the streets across the country?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is typical. After every match when Algeria does well, you have all these people in the street yelling and with all flags waving and the media goes out there and write about it and all of that stuff. It's really a day of celebration. I should say it's a night of celebration. And I think the Algerians deserve it. The country needs a break, needs to laugh, needs to enjoy life. Because remember, this is, again, a country that has lost about 200,000 people to terrorism. There are roadblocks everywhere in Algeria for 50 kilometers, which would be I don't know how many miles, a trip, it would take at least 2 hours for them to do. So this is really a time for them to enjoy and forget perhaps the problems that they have faced. So it's a well-deserved celebration.
Hamoud Salih, host of Radio Intifada on KPFK Radio Los Angeles, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
You're welcome, Alan and Jennifer.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Sirjan Ilic. And Sirjan is a Serbian blogger, however, based out of Australia. You can find his blog through Bleacher Report. And then his name is Sirjan Ilic again, which is Srdjanilic. Again, Srdjanilic. Type that in to Bleacher Report, and you can find his blog, which follows the Serbian national men's team in the 2010 World Cup. And I really wanted to speak to Sirjan because, again, Serbia, high hopes going into the tournament. They seem to really be in trouble after their loss to Ghana, and now they have certainly risen back up with a tremendous victory over Germany. How does it feel to be a Serbian fan less than 24 hours after what has to be one of the greatest victories in the history of Serbian soccer?
Well, to be honest, it's like shock, awe, relief, amazement, all those emotions. Sometimes I have a strong need to ask the question if some of our players think they're playing volleyball, not football,
yes,
with the amount of handballs, penalties, or conceding.
Yeah, they look like...
Very exciting.
They think they're playing Australian rules football or American football in the penalty box.
Yeah. So, the weird thing is the last World Cup happened too. I remember against Ivory Coast in our final group match at the German World Cup, we're leading 2-0 against Ivory Coast, and one of our players conceded two handball penalties. So, I don't know, are they trying to continue some weird tradition? I'm not sure.
Well, the side, has some great European stars on it. If people don't know this, Vidic, the central defender for Serbia, was actually the player of the year in the English Premiership last year, the third year that Manchester United won the title, a team that had Wayne Rooney, Cristiano Ronaldo. People don't know it. Ryan Giggs was voted by the players of the league as the player of the league, but the actual official award went to Vidic. So Serbia has some amazing talent. And so what did you make of the game against Germany? Was it just a matter of the team playing up to its capacity, which they hadn't done against Ghana?
Well, I feel that you're right in that sense. It was more about them just sticking to a game plan, because in qualifying, they had a game plan. They played passing football that was entertaining to a certain extent. But they followed Ange's philosophy, which is a passing game. And in the first game, people were wondering, they weren't going to creative outlets. Krasic, he hardly touched the ball. And in the second game, they just seemed to – They seem to just stick to their philosophy, pass the ball around, spread the ball, you know, create chances. They didn't play, well, to be honest, they didn't play the best, you know, last night, but they played good. They created chances. They didn't take all of them, but look, sometimes you have the luck. Me and my family are saying, for once you had luck, you know, one goal went in. They hit a post a few times. You know, we used to go to say penalty, you know, but that's the luck of the draw. You know, we won, so that's great. Now, hopefully, you know, the nation doesn't get too overawed again, because if we start a tournament, there are people saying, you know, it's either if we don't win afterwards, you know, people will find a failure. But for me, just getting out of the group stage will be a success. I think people need to keep their kind of expectations in check. Just getting out of the group stage will be an achievement.
Well, when the when Serbia scored their goal and the players ran over to the Serbian fans section, I mean, the exuberance, it really was, you know, one of these just visions of soccer exuberance that can't really be exceeded. It was really quite a scene. And the way that the players ran right to the fan section, that really seemed to suggest that, you know, the team really feels it's playing for the Serbian people. Is that your sense?
Yeah, well, they are. Like, this team, what has been talked about is, you know, a long time. Normally our teams have problems internally with infighting and, you know, in the past. But this team, many see them as a bit closer. There have been rumors of infighting in recent days, but I think that's more beat-ups by the media, maybe, because people were just very disappointed with the performance against Ghana. I thought it was going to become a witch hunt again, like it normally does, saying this team's pathetic, they've, you know, disappointed us. But I think people, like I said, just need to, you know, have realistic expectations. And, you know, they won last night, so now they're probably, the expectations will skyrocket again.
Now, obviously, Serbia has a very well-known political history from the 1990s. Americans, at least, are much less familiar with how things are currently in Serbia. Do you think it was especially poignant for Serbia to defeat Germany, given the recent political history and the role that Germany played in European politics in the 1990s?
Well, yeah, you know, Serbia is now leaning more towards a Western-style democracy. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, many Americans, maybe they don't know that much about that. But yeah, like the government's very Western now in their politics. So, and they're trying to get into the European Union. So all these things are mixed together. It's just showing Serbia when they're successful in sport, because everyone knows sport is the avenue to the world. Being successful in sport shows us to the world that we're changing. We are the Serbians of a different nation. So I guess you're right, yeah. Beating Germany is a very kind of symbolic victory.
And then looking forward, they have now to play Australia, a team that really got beaten up by the German side. However, of course, soccer being soccer, Australia is a side that traditionally has a lot of capacity to produce some nice offense, score some goals. So you never know what can happen in a match if someone scores first. But Serbia has to, I mean, in advance of the Ghana-Australia match tomorrow, they have to be feeling pretty good about their prospects for advancing again.
Well, they do. I think first match was as much nerves with the players having these expectations. They knew that they wanted, people were saying dark horses. People like football writer Jonathan Wilson and many others were predicting maybe for them to get to the semifinals, which is, you know, incredible, you know, when you think about it. So I think just that last night was just reassured them to not panic. Play football that they know, pass the ball, spread it, and you have confidence in yourselves. Like Krasic, last night he took on players. In the first game, I didn't even see him look at a player, let alone attempt to, you know, dribble past him or run at a player. So it was better. I think hopefully against Australia they can keep this up. I mean, Australia's media, as you know, I live in Australia, they just beat Australia up totally. They annihilated them in the media. The coach really suffered. There were calls for him to be sacked after the first game. Yeah. And to talk about player revolt. So, I don't know, maybe they'll come out and try and prove everyone wrong against Ghana. We'll see. So, I think we should not be overconfident. People were talking about, you know, beating Ghana pretty easily. They didn't have Michael Essien, but Ghana, a good team. And their coach is, Milovan Rajevac, is Serbian, so he knows us very well. So, we just have to, you know, concentrate on playing our own style and not worry too much about
expectations.
And so lastly, I'm talking again with Serjan Ilic, who is a blogger. You can find his blog on Bleacher Report. Final question, what were the scenes like? What do you understand the scenes to have been like in Belgrade after the victory?
Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah, it was wild. You know, from what I read, a lot of the people, you know, basically the first game stopped the nation, so I'm guessing it did again. You know, a lot of people happy, you know, they were very deflated after the loss. Because people, like I told you, they had high expectations, you know, because the media built them up. So people were, it was very, you know, wild scenes, I'm guessing.
So thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game. I've been speaking with Serjan Ilic, who's in Sydney, Australia. He is Serbian, and you can find his blog following the Serbian national team at the 2010 World Cup on Bleacher Report. Just do a search for Serjan Ilic, Serjan Ilic. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm speaking with Tomos Mikolakos. His blog is A Canucks Guide to Greece at the World Cup. You can find it at greece2010worldcup.blogspot.com. Welcome to The People's Game, Tomos.
How are you today?
I'm pretty good, and I imagine the people of Greece and soccer fans who root for Greece around the world were elated yesterday, no?
Oh, yeah, we were out on the streets. I mean, I was watching it down here on the Danforth. It's Greek town in Toronto. And, yeah, it was on a Thursday during the day. People were out on the streets with their flags going crazy, and it was really good to see.
I happened to have been in Chicago in the summer of 2004, and I actually didn't know I was in a Greek neighborhood. And then I found out that I was in a Greek neighborhood when they won.
Yeah,
I mean,
they have a big Greek community there too as well.
Oh, they just took over the streets of the neighborhood. I mean, the cars, the flags, and then I started to notice all the Greek bakeries that were around because I was just staying with a friend. So this side, obviously, the long history of the Greek national team in this decade has been remarkable. And expectations must have been sky high following 2004. Then they didn't make 2006. Again, for those who don't know, they won the European Championship, an amazing upset in 2004. And then they did qualify for this World Cup. What were expectations going into this World Cup?
Well, unfortunately, they're high because of, as you said, 2004 winning. It was just a shock. I mean, it was a surprise, and it was great to see. But, I mean, the team is still developing, and expectations were really high going in.
And then they really had severe disappointment in the first match. They just seemed to be outplayed in every aspect of the game versus South Korea.
Well, they were beat at their own game almost, set pieces. Set pieces did them in on the first goal early, and they never recovered after that.
Yeah, and they showed very little offensive creativity. I watched the match. Was that your sense as well?
Yeah, I mean, Rehagel's known, Otto Rehagel, the coach, he's known to play a defensive-minded system, and that's great because we don't have the stars to, like Ronaldo and Messi to like actually, you know, attack and have someone take control of the game. So you have to play a team game, and that's great and all, but you need goals to win, and his lineup for the first game was anything but offensive.
Yeah, and why was the central defender who plays for Liverpool out of the first match? And pronounce his name for me. It's always a little bit of a struggle.
Kyriakos.
Kyriakos, right. Why was Kyriakos out?
You know what? When I saw the lineup, I was shocked too. I mean, he's a big mountain at the back, and his presence in the air was needed. As you can see, the Koreans beat us on every aerial challenge, which is crazy because they're a lot shorter than the Greeks. So he was needed, especially in the box for the offensive zone. But I don't know. He just was left off the team sheet. It was just a strategical thing.
And for 33 minutes against Nigeria, it was more of the same, even worse, because it was one more game deep into the World Cup. And then a gift from heaven.
Yeah, you could say that. The Greek gods, everyone says. And it just bounced their way. It's part of the game, and it happened. I don't know what the Nigerian player was thinking, but it worked really well for the Greeks.
Yeah, it was Torosidis was out on the side of the field. It was an absolutely insignificant exchange, a ball bouncing out of bounds, and Sani Keita probably the one of the worst moments in the history of Nigerian football, just stuck a foot out. And that kind of move, is you're going to get a red card for it. And
yep,
and my take on the Greek side after that is they did prove themselves to be consummate professionals because they really knew how to play an advantage.
Well, exactly. I mean, you got to play the cards you're dealt. And for the first 33 minutes, it wasn't looking good. Same old story. And I was at a cafe on the Danforth, and everyone was down. Same old thing, and we're getting really, really low. And then it just shows you why it's called the beautiful game, because anything can happen, and you never know. And that was actually the thing.
Yeah, and it struck the German side today, who went from tournament favorites right into the pool of, you know, Italy, France, England, favorite sides.
All the great teams.
Right, are getting tripped up. But one that hasn't been tripped up is Argentina. And so Greece sits with 3 points along with South Korea. Actually, what's their separation on goals? They are
right now the Koreans have 3-4 and the Greeks have 2-3. So right now the Koreans are ahead just by having more goals.
Right.
So,
and
what will need to happen for Greece is if they can just hold Argentina to a tie. I know you don't want to hold the team to a tie. You want to go out and win. And I hope they go out to win. But if they can at least get a result and hope Nigeria can beat South Korea, that would work out for Greece to make it into the next round.
And Argentina are not qualified themselves, so playing for a cynical tie could work for both sides, though it's
exactly
hard to imagine all that Argentine firepower really even being able to play so cynically. And now Nigeria is not eliminated either, so no one's eliminated. But when you look at this team, let's maybe take it in the abstract, matching up against the Argentines. The Greeks are famous for playing solid defense that won them the 2004 Euro Championship. Do you think they could contain the Argentine talent?
Like I said, just the game is just so unpredictable. This World Cup has been unpredictable, and no one thought Algeria could hold the mighty England to a 0-0 draw, and it happened. So I think Greece can hold and contain, but one little crack in the armor, and it's the floodgates are going to open, and I could see that happening. 1994, Greece lost 4-0 with Maradona in the side, and I think it was his only World Cup game, his last World Cup game.
Yes,
and Greece were hammered 4-0. So you can see, I mean, different team now and then, but this team is too offensive. Like, you have to put on a united front to stop them.
Diego was especially charged on that day, so it seems, in 1994. So euphoria, though, yesterday in Greece. First ever World Cup victory. What have you heard about the scene in Athens? First question. Second question, what did the Greek papers say after that victory?
It was exactly what you expect. It was crazy. It was Greeks like to party, and when given a reason to celebrate, we do it better than a lot of people. And it was going crazy in the streets. I mean, I have family over there in Athens, and they were telling me that everyone was really, really charged after that victory. Same thing here in Toronto. Strong Greek community. It was just out, and it was going crazy. It was amazing to see.
And the papers in Greece, what did they have to say about it?
They were happy that Ray Hagel went with a more fresh approach. He did put in some of our attacking players, like the goal scorer, Salpingidis, who scored the first goal. He's one of our creative players, and having him out for 60 minutes of the first game really put us at a disadvantage, but he did well, and everyone was happy with what happened, I guess. I mean, how can you deny what the red card? That certainly turned the tide, but after that, they did play together and as a team, and the papers are looking at it well.
Yeah, no, they showed incredible cohesion after that red card. It's true. I was impressed with them after that occurred because they really took full advantage of it. And then, obviously, people going crazy in the streets of Athens, that has been a large headline across the world. Greece is in a severe economic crisis. In fact, one could even say it's now a social crisis. How does the success yesterday impact a country that's going, Greece, as it goes through this crisis? And secondly, the role of the Greek national team to the Greek people these days?
Well, the national team is it's tightly knit with the people. I mean, soccer is number one sport in Greece, and so everyone can relate to it. Now, as far as what's going on in the country, it's really low. I mean, people, you know, things are changing, and I don't want to speak for the people that are actually living through it, but yeah, I can't imagine the mood is too good, and just the team doing well and performing really gives you a different perspective on things, you know.
So it helps improves people in just a miserable circumstance.
Yeah, I would just more in the sense of you know, getting your mind off things and you know, seeing victory and tasting victory. You know, it every little bit helps.
Biggest match since the 2004 final for the Greek national team?
I would think so. In 2006 they didn't qualify for the World Cup, and in 2008, right off the bat, it didn't look good, and they were quickly eliminated. So I would say this one is definitely one of the most important matches, and it's great that it's with a side like Argentina, because they have a lot of history, and upsets can happen, and hopefully Greece can do it. I think it's the game's on Thursday.
Yeah, and I by the way, I own a 2008 Greece official shirt from the Euro Championships, and I'll wear it when they play. I promise you that, Thomas.
Thank you very much. Every little bit helps.
Well,
it is always appreciated.
I love Argentina, but I got to say, these games now at this point in this tournament are so exciting and so unpredictable. And, you know, Greece-Argentina right now, hells if I'm not going to root for the underdog in that match. So more power to you. I'll be with your side. And thank you so much for joining us here on the People's Game.
No problem. Enjoy the rest of the World Cup.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Tomos Michalakos. His blog is A Canucks Guide to Greece at the World Cup, and you can find it at Greece2010worldcup.blogspot.com. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Jennifer Doyle.
And right now we have on the line with us Paul Mason. He's the economics editor of BBC's Newsnight, has a fantastic blog called Idle Scrawl. And Paul Mason is not only a great fan of Manchester United, but also the English national side. Paul, that was flat.
It was a disaster. What's happening here right now on the social media, the Twitter sphere, is that everybody's turning on Fabio Capello, the coach. But I think this is unjustified. I mean, he has problems communicating. He's done a very inconsequential interview off the back of that game. But, you know, the other thing that's happened is that Wayne Rooney, our star striker, who I bigged up to your listeners only a week ago, came off the field and basically had a verbal outburst against the supporters, which I think is going to make the headlines tomorrow. So it's not a happy camp, and it shouldn't be, because they just didn't perform.
That's not a good sign, complaining about the fans. I mean, the fans were booing the team off the field, which is pretty dismal, but it's not a good sign of turning your blame outwards rather than inwards.
I think why they've done that, the mood is this. We now know that the Algeria team watched a quite famous film that may be known to some of your listeners before they went on the field. It's called Battle of Algiers, and it's by a guy called Gila Pontecorvo, and it's about the anti-imperialist struggle against the French in the 1950s.
Wait, they actually watched that?
They sat down and they relived a national myth.
Wow.
And our guys went out and didn't seem to have a national myth to relive. They didn't seem to know why they were there.
Wow. I mean, for those who haven't seen the film is a deeply, deeply moving film. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a difficult film.
And violent.
Yeah, and right. if you're looking for something to inspire someone to basically work through a difficult fight, it's a really compelling text. I'd seen this mentioned on the Twitter feeds, but I actually thought that they were making that up. I had no idea that was actually true.
No, apparently it's true. And the thing is, it relates to England because our guys, I mean, we've already talked on your show, I think, about the fact that they play for English clubs, they're very well paid, and they're surrounded by the best talent there is in the world. So you put them on their own on an international on an international stage. And even if you on an off night, even if you're 5 to 10% too much body fat, which I think they have, some of them, they don't look as lean and fit as some of the developing country players. Even if all that's true, you're up against it. You want to draw on some kind of a national myth, and that's what these supporters are drawing on. I mean, I don't know if people see it, but our supporters are there dressed as weird things like Crusader Knights or yeah. all sorts of other weird stuff that they've decided is part of their national story. It's like everybody turning up as either, I mean, pick your side, Confederate or Federal troops in the Civil War for you guys. Yeah. I mean, they turn up reliving these national myths, and then they get terribly disappointed by 11 millionaires who can't seem to work out how to do the basic thing of playing football. And we come back to the old thing about soccer. When it fails, it's really, really poor. You will not get an NFL game or a baseball game that fails and falls apart in this way. And it's all, I mean, all coaches, even minor league, even some college out there among your members will know it's about the mind. It's the top 2 inches of the body that is malfunctioning here.
Yeah, it's sad to, I'd say it's sad to watch, except that I think we've been living with this for so long, those of us who've been following the English side. And there's been this moment under Capello where I think people have been actually optimistic about England's campaign in the World Cup, barring, I think, maybe the last few games coming into the actual tournament. They seem to have their act together, and they seem to be playing a different kind of game. Might not be an inspiring game, but it was at least a successful one. Whereas what we saw today, I have to confess, it actually put me to sleep for about 20 minutes.
Well, we are getting up awfully early out here on the West Coast and running ourselves a little ragged to watch the matches. But, I mean, Steven Gerrard, Gareth Barry, and, of course, most of all, Wayne Rooney, I thought were utterly wretched. And as much as Lennon was inconsequential, I thought, I mean, of course, he's not going to replace Rooney, but he should have. Replace Rooney.
No, look, I thought Barry did all right, actually. I think the problem is that there's a strategic choice here for Capello. Does he stick with 4-4-2, which is the culture of the players, and his culture, or does he go for a more adventurous formation? Now, he's clearly trying to get through the group stage using 4-4-2 and making that function, making the plan A work. I think that's not wrong, and I think people are wrong to turn on him for trying to do that. But the interesting thing is that the rising buzz here, again, on the social media, listening to it throughout the game, is that the players don't like Capello now. And the reason they don't like him is because he's coaching them. He's actually saying, stick to your formation, stick to what we told you to do. I've seen England implode before now. I mean, literally implode in the way that Steve Gerrard will run 90 metres from one end of the pitch to another in a crazy way in the last 5 minutes of the game just to try and do something spectacular. And Capello's clearly saying to them, no, don't do that. Play to a system. We will get there. Mm-hmm. And if they all come off the pitch and start sledging him really badly, which is, I think, I've got a feeling we're going to get headlines in Britain tomorrow where the players turn on him. I think that's unfair because whether England like system or not, I've said this and I said it on your program last week, the team that wins this World Cup will be the best coached, the best drilled, the best disciplined. That's the way Brazil are playing. Argentina, even those flair, amazing players, they're still part of a disciplined team. That's how you win a tournament these days, because everybody's got it. Everybody can defend. Everybody understands midfield play. You've got to be disciplined. And you can't revolt and suddenly decide you're going to go to some kind of a strategy of chaos, which I have a horrible feeling some of these powerful players in the England camp will now try and do.
Well, it's interesting with Argentina because for all of Maradona's declaration, it's going to be attack, attack, attack. Who cares who I choose from the back line? He has four established on the back line with a holding midfielder in Mascherano. It's not
the most powerful player in that Argentina lineup is three tiers above the field of play in the stands, and his face is on a giant banner next to Maradona's.
Che Guevara.
It's Che Guevara. Yeah, look, you know, that's all you need. You have to be able, when you look up and you've missed the goal, you see Maradona's face and Che Guevara, you kind of know what you're playing for.
Yeah.
Our guys look up and all they see are little dollar signs and a future Lamborghini sports car. That's the problem. And it's not, they're not the only ones. You know, I think the French have got the same problem.
Yeah.
The Dutch have got a kind of apparently some kind of racial tension in the team. Once it's eating away, once this thing that, look, I'm a millionaire, why do I need this? We've seen individual sports people this year fall apart under that kind of pressure, and teams can do it as well.
I found myself actually thinking that while I was watching the match, that these guys look like they just want to go home and go on vacation, that they look like they're done working.
Well, I think the French team have looked like that. The French team hate being there. They don't like the manager. And if England let themselves get into that situation, it would be very, very unfortunate for them, because he's not a bad manager, and they are not bad players. Some of them, you know, if it was me, I'd be tempted to move away from the 4-4-2. But I wouldn't do it against against Slovenia. I would stick with it, and I'd say, guys, we can make this work, but you have got to, you've got to believe.
You know, you talk about motivating myths for the national soccer sides. And earlier when we spoke, and I'll ask you about them in a second, you mentioned Serbia. Mm-hmm. But I also want to actually touch on that with the U.S. men's team today.
Yeah.
And for them, I think what they play for right now is bringing soccer to the United States. And I think they really threw themselves and all of their heart onto that field in the second half. And Landon Donovan.
I think they did. And I only caught the second half, actually. I was watching it in an Italian bar in London. And the Italians were all rooting for the Slovenians. So the Americans didn't get much of a look in. And they did. They threw themselves into it. You could see the passion with which they did it. But also, it's about hunger, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, in every profession, you're a journalist, I'm a journalist. The hungry people are the ones who get the story. The ones who've kind of done it all and just want to sit back on their laurels are the ones who don't. It's a common problem.
Mm-hmm.
But why? You know, I mean, we are talking now like a tens of million, probably in hundreds of millions spent on this England team.
Yeah.
Why?
Boy, do I wish they'd direct some of that money to their women's side.
Well, exactly.
And did you see the Serbia-Germany match? Because you had spoken about how you felt that Serbia would be an extremely motivated side, also a talented side. They can't seem to stop throwing their hands up in the box and catching balls once a game. But at least this time the Wigan Athletic goaltender blocked Podolski's penalty. But did you see the celebration on the goal?
No, I missed it, actually.
Oh, it was something else. I mean, these guys, they responded to facing elimination against who were supposed to be the hottest side in the tournament, and they were helped by a lot of cards coming out earlier from a referee who was really doing a wretched job and closely got sent off. But Serbia certainly stepped up. You had tapped them as a team you thought that might be a sleeper in the tournament.
I mean,
and they...
They're a team with a national myth and some discipline. I think that's thinking about this, actually, as the tournament has gone on, it is, you need discipline. You need, as it were, extremely fluid tactical coaching, and you need a national myth. And I keep emphasizing this. I know it's utterly, utterly trivial and basic, but you need body fitness.
And
I think that, you know, some of these European players, the England ones are not the only ones, they look a little bit muscle-bound.
Yeah.
And you watch Algeria come running onto the pitch, and I quite like it when footballers have waists. You know, I'm wondering whether it's me, whether I've got some kind of fetish about this, but I quite like it to be able to see that they go in and out again.
Yeah.
Some of our guys don't. And it's not because they're too fat. It's just because they've developed a kind of body shape that isn't helping them play the game they play. Mm. It would help them play a different game.
Would you say that's
rugby union?
Is that a reflection
of NFL?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you think that's a reflection of the physicality of the English game, where there's this sense that you need to have this kind of body mass to play this very confrontational physical game?
Absolutely, that is a reflection of the English game. And I'm also wondering about this body shape issue, but it's also part of a European football thing. It's about the fact that it's played at a very high intensity, and there is a size issue. But I'm just really impressed by small teams winning. I really, really quite impressed by the fact that, because the rules now prevent people from using physical size to just literally bundle people off the ball in an unfair way, you get teams terrified of being red carded, and therefore even quite physically dominant teams like England, like Germany, like France, are backing off from physically smaller teams. I mean, I have to say that, you know, in a week when we all worry about things like banking regulation and does it work, well, football regulation is working.
Yeah.
What it means is that there is a level playing field between different nations and sort of DNA groups, and they can all play the game. And the Algerians were not the biggest set of people, but they dominated England in midfield.
They played a big game.
Yeah, and we're all really, I'll tell you, I've been monitoring the social media here. The people are, as we say, gutted. They are outraged by the response. And the apparently an England fan has invaded the dressing room and berated people, and Rooney has outbursted to the cameras. And I think in the tabloids, as you know, we have a very febrile tabloid media here. I think the tabloids are going to be quite exciting to read tomorrow.
Can't wait.
and they can't pin it all on Robert Green.
No.
Well, for this time, no. And actually, the goalie played the best.
Yeah, he did.
I think James played really well.
And he seemed appalled at what was in front and right in front of him.
Was,
I mean.
He was.
Yeah, it's a little bit like medieval court, really. They have courtiers, and in the form of tamed sports journalists who they will be even now speaking to try and give their side of the story. And by the time we get to press deadlines tonight, 2 or 3 hours time, you know, it'll be a bit like sort of the Guelphs versus the Ghibellines in 14th century Florence. You know, somebody's got the knife out already.
That's a lovely image.
I should say the Montagues or Capulets, just in case people don't understand Florence, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're speaking to Americans, Paul.
I know. I'm an English professor.
Yeah, they
know. I'm supposed to know these things.
No,
right?
No, Americans, so. We don't know. We know Palin and Obama. That's about as far back as we go. BP versus the Gulf.
The Earls and the Clantons.
Oh, what's the Kentucky group? The
Hatfields and McCoys.
You got it. Yeah, we know the Hatfields and McCoys. Or somebody.
Okay.
Yes. Well, Paul Mason, BBC Newsnight economics editor, diehard Man U fan, and analyst.
Football theorist.
And football theorist and analyst of the sorry English World Cup side. I didn't ever see it going this bad, this fast for that side.
Nope.
Thank you so much again for joining us on
My pleasure.
People's Game.
Thank you.
We'll see you in the quarterfinals.